Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCellaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, November 9th, 2014, and this is show number 496. Before I get started, I want to give a shout-out to Haley. She's out in England and sad that she can't be in the live chat room, but I thought if we gave her a shout-out, it would maybe make up for the fact that it's 1 in the morning her time, and she says that's just a wee bit late for her. I promised her sometime in the future we'll do a midday show so she could join in. Well, let's see. We've got a huge show for today. It's going to be fantastic. But before we dig in, I wanted to tell you that Steve and I are taking a short jaunt off to New York to visit the New Zealand professors next weekend. To keep symmetry intact, New Zealand's own Alistair Jenks will be taking the reins of the NoCellaCast in my absence. As always, when we have a guest host, I sure hope if you've got an idea for a short 3 to 5 minute review of a product you're enjoying, or maybe a tech rant or a dumb question, you'll send them to Alistair for inclusion in the show. The best place to send them is to zkarj, that's Z-K-A-R-J, at me.com, at me.com. And it's never a bad idea to CC me over at Allison at podfeet.com. Just in case something gets mixed up, I can make sure it gets to him. If you've never submitted an audio review before, be sure to check out the link in the show notes to the page called Record Your Own Review. If you're too lazy to find the show notes, it's a link at the top of every page on podfeet.com. In there, you'll find out the best way to record and send the audio files to us. I'm really looking forward to Alistair's show. He's a great host with an amazing voice, and he won't tell me who he's got chit-chat across the pond scheduled, but he promises that I'll like it. All right, like I said earlier, we've got a huge show today, so let's get started with a very, very quick listener contribution.
Hello, Allison and Acilla Castaways. I'm here today with a review for the usage widget for iOS 8. The usage widget, once added to your widgets in the notification panel, will display your in-use and free RAM, the free space on your iOS device, as well as the current real-time CPU and Wi-Fi 3G 4G usage. I enjoy having this widget, as I like to be able to look at what my iOS device is doing, as well as when your iOS device is lagging or seems blocked up, it's nice to be able to check at a glance what's happening with your device. The app is available on any iOS 8 device. One of the perks I felt with Android was being able to check a lot of system factors and usage. This widget I feel is on par with what is available for Android. Although the app is currently quite basic, they say that in future updates there will be further user face customizations available, which will be cool. All the best.
Well, after I listened to Johnny's review, I got all excited. I ran over to my phone and I pulled down the notification center in iOS and I scrolled to the bottom where it says edit so I could enable this usage widget he was talking about. But I couldn't find it. Completely baffled, I wrote to Johnny to accuse him of teasing me, and only then did he confess that usage widget is actually something you go get from the App Store. Simply search for usage widget and you get a free download. When I tapped on open, I got a very simple screen telling me the widget is installed. After that, usage showed up in my notifications under edit, and now I too can see my memory usage by free, active, and a third category that's in white text in about 1-point font on a pink background. No idea what that one was. I can see my Wi-Fi speeds and my CPU usage as a really nice graph. I'm betting this is way more interesting when something is borked up, as he says. For now, it's a fun thing to look at and very cool that Apple is finally letting us have some diagnostics. Now, let's see a show of hands for how many people want iSnap menus as a widget on their iOS devices. I went back to the app itself, and it turns out that page that tells you usage widget is installed as a today extension also shows me some of the same info as the widget. Not all of it, not as cool as the widget. But in much bigger type, I can see it's free, inactive, active, and wired usage of memory. That was the thing in the little tiny text I was talking about. And it also shows me that I've got 44.45 gigabytes of free space on my 64 gigabyte iPhone. I definitely like the widget capability more, but it was nice to know what those little bars said on them. I put a link in the show notes to usage widget for now, so go get it. It's free. And Johnny, thanks for the quick review. Man, you just get these reviews in and out and done. No wasting time. You're like the Twitter master here, getting the short and succinct reviews. This weekend, Steve and I traveled to see his parents to upgrade his mom from a white MacBook, very, very old, I think it's a 2007, to a brand new shiny Mac Mini. I love working with Merlee, his mom, because she's so clever and quick. She has her own way of doing things like any of us, but she really listens to me before deciding whether she's going to take my advice. She often does, but she always listens. As you know, I've been trying to convince both of them to use a password manager for ages, and they haven't yet budged on that. I even converted myself to 1Password partly so that I could be able to give them good support on it if I ever talked them into it. By the way, I was leaning towards 1Password because their main concern is the cloud. They don't trust it for anything. So having a tool that can live only locally was why 1Password would be the right tool for them. But like I said, I haven't talked them into it yet. Anyway, converting her old Mac to her new one was delightfully easy. I'd never done this before for somebody else, and I'd never done it using Time Machine. First, I verified that her Time Machine backup had run recently, and luckily it had. It's been pretty consistent for the last couple years. At the beginning, it was kind of dodgy, but it seems to have gotten a lot better. I had run the Mac Mini through its paces when I had it at home to make sure it was in working order, so I launched the admin account I had created and then launched Migration Assistant. It actually took me, I had to do a Google search to figure out where Migration Assistant lives. I'm used to seeing it pop up automatically when you get a new computer, but I didn't know how to just launch it in the middle of being in the middle of, an account session. So it turns out it's hidden in application/utilities. One of the options was to migrate user data and applications from a Time Machine backup. I chose that, and we went off to entertain ourselves while her 162 gigabytes of data transferred to her new 1 terabyte Fusion drive. When it was all done, she had her user account just as she'd had it before, which was actually kind of a shame. I had promised her that her user account would no longer be called Ken, that it could be her own name. But anyway, it came up as Ken, and it even had her rotating desktop background. When I saw that, I realized she had a 2007 MacBook that was just grindingly slow, and I wonder how much of that had to do with the fact that she had this rotating desktop background. I mean, it's rotating maybe every 5 minutes. Probably was a shame, but at this point, it didn't matter because now she's got this fantastic new machine with 8 gigabytes of RAM, and it's got a 2.6 gigahertz Intel, Core i5 processor, so it's a smoking little machine. Anyway, now I've got her new user account, and I saw a fair number of question marks in her doc, so that whole migrating of applications appears to be somewhat overstated. I knew Microsoft Office would be the hardest thing and the most important thing to get running. Luckily, she still had the download .dmg for Office from when we had bought it earlier, and she had a lovely folder with the serial number she'd been issued when we bought her Office 2011, a short time ago. It was maybe 6 months back. We ran the installer, and it came back with server not responding. Well, after that, I started thinking, I did set aside 24 hours to get her going. We were going to spend the night, make sure it was working by the next morning. But, now I'm thinking, man, like half of that's probably going to be taken up fighting with Microsoft to get this thing up. And I'm just really sad about that. Good news, though. Steve's dad, Ken, had accidentally knocked the router over earlier, and without realizing it, I think he must have bumped the button on the top that actually puts the router in standby mode. Now, why would that button even exist? Why is there a standby button on top? Why would you want that? Well, I discovered that was the problem, and a simple tap of the button, and we were back on the internets, and we were able to register Office. I was quite relieved. Now, I did try to unregister Office on her old computer, hoping to forestall any future problems, but it is so complicated. And, I've been down that road. You go back and look it up. It was hours and hours and hours trying to unregister Office on a machine. And since it was working fine on the new computer, I abandoned that whole path and I moved along. It was really fun watching her open her Excel and Word files and giggle with joy at how fast the new machine was. I did have to clean her dock up a bit at that point, though, and get rid of things like Outlook and MSN Messenger. I'm pretty sure they discontinued MSN Messenger, didn't they? Anyway, these things had rudely installed themselves, and I just, out of sight, out of mind, I didn't uninstall them. I just simply got them out of her dock. I opened up Mail, and we entered her Gmail account username and password. Her mail came flooding in, including new emails since we'd started working. Now, remember this step, because it comes back into play later. Now that her real productivity was all set, we went to play with iPhoto. Opening iPhoto in the past was a measure of a woman's patience. It took forever to do anything with iPhoto on that poor old machine. It really sucked the joy out of playing with photos. She again squealed with delight at the speed when we opened iPhoto on the new machine. I suggested we play around with the share option so we'd be sure she could use Facebook and email to share her photos. And that's when things started to go horribly wrong. For some reason, iPhoto has an independent connection to email. doesn't pick up your mail preferences. You have to enter things like, you know, the server, you know, the SMTP dot blah blah, and what port it's on, all this stuff, which makes zero sense to me. But in this case, we also had another problem. All of the sharing options were grayed out. We configured iPhoto with their Gmail username and password, but sending a photo failed. I raced back to that darn router to see if the lights were off again, but it was fine, and other surfing was fine. We went into sharing again, and again the options were grayed out, even the mail option, which we had configured. I did some more of the Googles, and I found people saying that quitting and restarting iPhoto would fix us right up, and it did. Back into sharing, and now we have all of the options not grayed out, and mail is ready to send over to Gmail, but it still wouldn't send. Now, I'm actually trying to remember just when and where things got so much worse. But it was either in iPhoto or possibly back in Mail, we suddenly got a message that her password for Gmail was wrong. Now, this was very curious because, as I mentioned earlier, we configured her account over in Mail.app and it was working fine. I mean, we had new email coming in. We went to gmail.com in Safari and had her try her login there, but it said her username or password was incorrect. Now, this whole time, she's been referring to a secret piece of paper she keeps hidden in a very, very good hiding place, and it's got all of her passwords on it, and we're looking right at the password. I mean, it's printed out. It's right there. We know she typed it in earlier, so there should be no confusion. We worked on this for probably, 10 or 15 minutes, and baffled at what else we could do, Steve and I could only think of one other option, and that was to reset her password. So now we're at gmail.com when we did this, right? I pushed the button and it announced it had sent the recovery message, recovery email address to her other account over in Cox.net. I should interject here that a year ago or so, I configured her Cox.net email to forward over to her Gmail account so that she'd get IMAP instead of POP and she'd be able to read and respond to emails on both her iPad and Mac without problems. And it's been working great. But this means she hasn't logged directly into her Cox.net address in ages. So, now we have to get into that address to recover her Gmail account. She says, I don't know what that password is. So think about it. Let's let that one rest for a moment. We have now locked her out of all of her email. She can't get into Cox.net. She can't get into Gmail. So, started thinking, maybe, just maybe, her email as logged into her old Mac to Gmail would still receive the email. But no matter how hard we pushed that fetch mail icon on her old machine, no new emails came in. Now, Merle understood the gravity of what had just happened, and she sat there mournfully in her chair, feeling guilty for not knowing the password. I explained gently to her that this is exactly why password managers are out there, because as humans, we're not good at this. It's not that Merle is bad at it. We are bad at it. This is something we're not good at, and this is how these things go wrong. Now, the story does have a good ending. Steve got an idea. He thought, you know, that Cox email address was created so long ago, maybe, just maybe, she and her husband Ken had chosen the same password. We got Ken's password, went to webmail for Cox.net, and we got in. And right there waiting for us was the password reset from Google. To say that there was a collective sigh of relief does not do justice to how the three of us felt. I looked at Merle and I said, when we get this fixed, we're buying 1Password and you're starting to use it today. And she happily agreed. Well, it was high time for cocktails by this time. So as we sipped a glass of wine on the back patio to celebrate our near-death experience, we brought up Bart's beta of his XKPassWD service. And after setting a few parameters, I asked her to look at the 3 passwords it suggested. She looked at one of them and said, I can remember that. We went to dinner, and when we got home, we went back upstairs, bought 1Password, and entered a half dozen of her passwords, and had her practice saying her new master password over and over and over again until we were sure she could do it. If there's ever a story to tell about why to use a password manager, I think this story of success captured from the jaws of ultimate disaster really tells that tale. Do you have a recurring bill going on that just seems like more than it should be? I would really encourage you to call the company that owns that bill and simply ask them to lower the price. Now, you would think this wouldn't work, but I can swear that it does. Sometimes you have to do play a little bit of chicken with the companies, but it's amazing how often this works at its simplest levels. Years ago, Time Warner sent us a notice saying that they were increasing our rate by something like, $20, $30 a month. I called them on the phone and simply said, no, you're not. I explained to the woman that answered that it would be expedient if she simply moved me up to her manager right away. She agreed. When the manager got online, I politely explained that I had options. Verizon Fios was available to me. She took a look at my account, asked me what was important to me in my TV and internet service. In about 5 minutes, not only were we not paying $30 more a month, we were paying $15 less per month. All I did was ask. I have a combined data plan for my Verizon iPad and MiFi. If you haven't heard of the MiFi, it's a small portable device that gets a cell data signal and it spits it out as Wi-Fi, so you have your own personal hotspot anywhere you go. I suspect they're not as prevalent as they used to be now that so many phones can do the same function. But back when I bought it, the better financial plan for me was to have them subsidize it. I'm paying $60 a month for 4 gig of data for the two devices, my iPad and my MiFi, and that's also paying off the MiFi. On average, I use less than 1 gigabyte of data since I only use the MiFi when I'm out of town. Unfortunately, when I do need the MiFi, I always run out of the 4 gigabyte within a day or two. So I called Verizon. All I said was, you know, I don't really want to pay this much anymore. Is there something you can do? The woman worked on it for quite a while, and in the end, she dropped my bill by $6 a month. It's only 10%, but hey, it's better than nothing. But at the same time, she raised my limit to 6 gigabytes. All I did was ask. A few weeks ago, I got tired of paying HBO since we were only needing it when Game of Thrones was on. $20 a month is just draining out of the old account for no reason. We tried looking around for other stuff to watch on HBO, but then realized that was a kind of a dumb way to do it. Why not watch stuff on the stuff we do use? So I went online and canceled HBO. This week, I got an email from our ISP explaining that they decided to give me complimentary HBO on my account. I thought that was hilarious. I guess technically I didn't ask in this case, but it worked anyway. A long time ago, I called my ISP, and I told the woman who answered the phone that I really liked my service. I told her I had no intention of changing companies. And then I asked her what would have happened if I had threatened to leave. Again, I reiterated I did not want to leave. She lowered my bill. All I did was ask. So if you have a bill you don't like, just call the company up. Tell them you want it to be lower. See what happens. I bet a lot of you out there have stories much like mine, so be sure to share them with us. As many of you know, my dad was my hero. He was a mechanical engineer, and I tagged after him in the garage, the shop, and outside pretty much anywhere he would let me follow. One of my earliest memories is sitting on a very tall stool in his shop and toppling right over to the concrete. I don't think I suffered any ill effects from that, but I don't remember. I do also remember when I was hospitalized as a child, unrelated to the falling off the stool thing, and my dad brought me a small yellow-handled, it was a flathead screwdriver, as a present. My mom thought that was stupid, but I was delighted. Later, he bought me my first toolbox, and we had many happy hours in the shop together. When I was in college to become a mechanical engineer myself, someone broke the antenna off of my 1976 Honda Civic. I went to the local hardware store and I found a replacement for it. Antennas in those days, for you kids who don't remember them, they were telescoping metal rods with a long wire that ran down the A pillar between the front window and the right passenger window. Installation of my new antenna looked trivial. I removed the two screws holding the mounting plate of the broken one, crawled under the dash, unplugged the connector to the radio. Then I simply pulled down the wire from above until it was completely removed from the pillar. That's when it hit me. Why didn't I tie something to it before I pulled it out? I remember I called my dad beating myself up about it. I told him what bothered me most was that he would have thought of tying something to it before he pulled it out. My father was such a great teacher. This was nearly 40 years ago, and I still remember what he said to me. He said, "How many times do you think I pulled it out first before I started to remember to tie something to it?" So instead of telling me I was a dope, which is what I was calling myself, he gave me hope that maybe someday I'd be smarter than that. Okay, so what does that have to do with today's story? What's another story of ingenuity, in this case of Steve's ingenuity? Many years ago, we gave our daughter Lindsay a Mac tower to put in her room, but there was no Ethernet in her room, and it was long before the days of Wi-Fi. Her room's on the other side of the hall from our room where the router is, and the only way to get from hers to ours is up over the top into the attic and back down. Where we live, walls are made of wood structures with wall board over them, and every few feet there's a firebreak piece of wood, making dropping a wire down between walls virtually impossible. You have to punch a hole above and below the firewall, drag the wire over, or drill a hole through it, patch and paint the wall. Steve did not want to do that for obvious reasons. Then he had an awesome realization. We have the luxury of a built-in vacuum system, and the hoses go from the attic down into our room. It's actually a pipe that goes down from the attic down into our room, and there's another one that goes down into hers. He realized since there's already this hose pipe going down the wall, it must go through the firebreak wood piece, so that means there might be enough space to drop a wire down below, right next to the pipe. We got a 100-foot Ethernet cable. He dropped it down from above, and down below, with a vacuum hose cover plate pulled off, I was able to see the dangling wire and catch it with a coat hanger. The truly elegant part was when he gouged a groove into the drywall next to the cover plate for the vacuum and just slapped that cover plate back on with the wire hanging out of the side. It was awesome. I loved it, but it did the trick. Well, fast forward to today when we have the two Drobos in the house, the old one and the new one. We did a lot of speed tests during that file transfer marathon and figured out, because I'm slow sometimes, that gigabit Ethernet cables are way faster than 100 megabit cables. The cable we dropped from the attic to those many years ago, down the pipes, was a Cat5 or 100 megabits per second instead of Cat5e or Cat6 that we have today, which is 1,000 megabits per second or gigabit Ethernet. That doesn't really work out to 10 times as fast, but it's way, 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 way more faster. The other problem to be solved is that we'd really like to have both Drobos live in Lindsay's old room. The new Drobo 5N was sitting on the floor under my desk, and while I think it's marvelous as a foot warmer, Steve would prefer it wasn't available for me for that function. The good news is that the 5N is much quieter than the older FS, so at least the noise hasn't bothered us having it in our room. So now we need not one, but two cables to go to Lindsay's room. So guess what we did? Steve tied something to it. He taped the two cables to the existing one. He staggered the end so that the connectors didn't make one giant bulge in the cable, and he was able to taper the bulges in hopes of it actually fitting through the tiny gap we'd used before. I'm going to jump to the end of the story. After him crawling in the creepy attic with fiberglass insulation and bugs and dust, and me sitting on the nice clean carpet in the bedrooms, we were able to push and pull those cables all the way up one wall and back down the other, and we now have gigabit Ethernet to the Drobo server room. If you take a single lesson away from today's story, it is tie something to it first. Remember how Dorothy created a tutorial teaching us how to create a safe version of Chrome that would force SSL in our browsing? Well, a good friend of the show who goes by the name Horse in the chat room wrote to me and Dorothy explaining that if you're not running as administrator, then you won't be able to save your new application from Automator directly into the applications folder. He gave us the instructions to follow in this instance, which weren't hard, but it was a little different way to do it if you are not an administrator. Now, I want you to think right now about if you had created the documentation, say, at work or instructions for your friend and family. If you don't use Clarify for your instructions, you're probably sensing that dread of launching Microsoft Word, plopping in those extra words and watching all of your formatting just go in the garbage heap. Images inserted have jumped to the wrong pages, your text isn't wrapping properly anymore, and it's basically a giant mess that's going to take you forever to fix. Well, guess what? Didn't take me forever to fix because Dorothy did it in Clarify. I popped open Dorothy's glorious tutorial in Clarify, plopped in the extra text, and I hit the publish button to podfeet.com, and I was done. Now, I could have exported to Word or PDF. It would have been just as beautiful as her original. All of the friction is eliminated with Clarify. If you're still fighting with Word, or heaven forbid you're doing PowerPoint to make documentation, just stop shooting yourself. Do you hate yourself? Why would you do that? Do yourself a favor and go over to clarify-it.com and be sure to tell them Allison sent you when you inevitably buy Clarify. And thanks so much to Horse for letting us know so we can improve the tutorial for everyone. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond, and Bart Bouchatz is back to finish the teaser we started about networking last week.
I am, but I have loads of stuff to do before then.
I should say 2 weeks ago. Yeah, yeah. I was just looking at the early stuff, and it looks meaty, so let's dig in.
Yeah, we have two security mediums that I think we should do before we go into security like proper. So the first of those is WireLurker, which is making the news.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a piece of malware that sits on your Mac. That sits on a Mac, waits for someone to plug in an iOS device, and then tries to infect the iOS device. And the media has gone completely tonto for this. Like, you know, the end of the world, the end of the world, a whole new change, blah, 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 new era in, no, absolute rubbish.
But only if you're in China, right?
it's not even only if you're in China. The reality exists everywhere. So the way this actually works is... So the way it's spreading is not even remotely remotely novel. It's spreading using... It's just embedded into pirated software. So it's basically a Trojan, like we've seen a million and one times. So there's nothing novel there. And what it does is it uses the way that iTunes talks to your phone to push apps to your phone. But what you won't read from most media reports is that, those apps can't run unless you accept the certificate that they're signed with.
And is the certificate... how do you see a certificate on the iPhone?
So you see it as a provisioning profile.
Oh, one of those things you have to install?
Right. So a big pop-up says provisioning profile. It will say unsigned, telling you that Apple don't have a clue whose profile this is you're about to accept. If you are foolish enough to accept a provisioning profile, yes, then you can run software written by someone else.
Right.
Really ear-chattering.
There are cases where you want to do that. Like Donald Burr is about to release the beta for the NosillaCast app. In order to run a beta, you have to accept and install a profile.
Correct. And that's what they're for. And so if you're expecting to receive a profile, by all means, accept the profile. But if you're just wandering around and suddenly you get a pop-up for a profile that you didn't ask for, the answer is no.
Yeah.
Always. So, you just wouldn't tell that from reading the headlines. You know, installs apps on non-jailbroken iPhones. Well, install implies run, and these things actually won't run. They're, the bits are there, but they can't go until you accept the provisioning profile. So, I'm not sure that counts as installing.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I must have misunderstood, or it was poorly reported. We'll go with poorly reported. I thought that the site in China that was hosting the software was a reasonably legitimate site, like a Softpedia or a download.com. So in that middle gray area of a little bit creepy, but not pirated software?
I don't know. I don't read Chinese. I can't comment.
Okay. So one of the things I'd asked you whether we should chat a little bit about is there's full on pirate software sites, right? Like where you go and go, "Ooh, I can get Photoshop for free. That what could possibly go wrong?" We've talked a lot about don't do that or do it and quit your whining when everything goes horribly wrong. And then there's the fully legitimate sites where you know you're going to Agile Bits and you're downloading 1Password or you're getting GetCloak from GetCloak.com. Those are real sites. And you've also got the Mac App Store that you know has been vetted and everything. But then there's these Softpedias and Download.coms that I think used to be legitimate, but you have convinced me that Download.com from CNET is full of horrible things, semi-horrible things, right?
Yeah, it's all legal. It's just icky.
And they started putting in toolbars, and they have installers that put crapware on your machine, that kind of thing. So maybe it's not complete and utter malware, but it's annoyware at the very least.
It's certainly stuff you didn't want and that you ended up with without asking for, I think is bad practice.
Yeah, yeah, and I think we're going to circle back to that at the end of this discussion.
We are.
But I think it's important to know that places like Softpedia are not fully clean. They're kind of sleazy. They kind of will put some crap on your machine. If you search for a piece of software and you find it through Softpedia, spend some time figuring out where the legitimate download site is from that vendor and go directly there is what my advice would be.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. And unfortunately, there's no guaranteed way. You just kind of have to
read
and I guess use your intuition to some extent, which is imperfect, but
I've been able to go in there and say, okay, this says it's from a company called Cloak. Let me do a search directly for that company separately, even if I can't find the link right there.
But as we'll discover when we circle back, that doesn't always work.
Okay.
But it's the right idea, right? And it's going to make you as safe as you can be.
Yeah. Do you want to circle back right now?
Well, we may as well. Yeah, we'll skip back. So I'm often asked for advice. You know, Windows user, could you recommend the free FTP client? And I've just always gone, yeah, FileZilla, that'll do.
Yeah, FileZilla's good. It's kind of crappy looking, but it's functional.
Yeah, it's a very Linux interface. It's a very crude shell around the FTP command line. Like open sourcey.
But it gets her done.
It does. And I've been using it myself on Windows for years and recommending it for years. And I recommended it this week. And the person I recommended it to ended up with their homepage hijacked, ads on websites that don't actually have ads because the ads weren't coming from the websites. Yeah. So FileZilla send you to... So if you go to FileZilla and you click on their default download button, you get taken to SourceForge. And on SourceForge, if you click the default download button, you get a .exe installer. And that .exe installer, unless you read very, very carefully and click on the advanced button to go find the checkboxes to uncheck, you get a whole bunch of junk along with FileZilla.
Really?
And if you're very careful and you read all the small print, you actually know that you should go to SourceForge, then go to other downloads and then choose the zip file and then get it from the zip file instead of from the .exe file.
I'm looking right now, even at the Mac OS X download, it says Mac OS X, big green button, download SourceForge, trusted for open source. And right below it, not in very small print, but I still wouldn't have read it, it says this installer may include bundled offers. Check below for more options. So then it says show additional download options. So you have to go there to get out of it.
Exactly. And to me, if you're relying on users not reading the fine print to make your money, I would say that you have started to be in breach of Wheaton's law, and I want nothing to do with you.
What is Wheaton's law?
Don't be a dick.
Oh, who's that? Will Wheaton's law?
Will Wheaton, yes.
Oh, really?
You're familiar with Wheaton's law? Oh, no. You need to follow the link and watch the presentation. It's from a very famous talk he gave at, that big GamerCon. Comic-Con.
Oh, is it the one where he talks to the little girl?
Might be.
Okay.
It's definitely a very famous Will Wheatonism. I think it sums up things pretty well because, you know, there's no one here doing anything illegal.
Right.
I just find it ick and immoral. Therefore, I am, as of this week, never recommending FileZilla ever again. And I'm never going near SourceForge ever again. Once bitten, twice shy.
Wow, it's going to be hard to never go to SourceForge. There's an awful lot of good stuff there.
I'm just going to do my best to get it from other sources. Because, well, SourceForge had been starting down a slippery slope with me anyway, because they started to have those ads that look like download buttons.
Oh, I hate that. I have fallen for that, I would say, 30% of the time I press the wrong button.
Yeah, and that to me is, again, that's just tricking people to try and make some ad revenue. I'm sorry, but I have no interest in the website that is trying to fool me.
Yeah, really. If one of the buttons said donate, I might push that from time to time on purpose.
Well, yes, exactly. And I don't have anything against people making money from open source software. I just have something against people making their money what I would consider to be dishonestly.
Yeah, that's pretty creepy. So Bart has a link to a full blog post he did on that explaining his perspective. And I think you have a link to Wheaton's Law there, right?
I do indeed, which has a description and a video.
That's really disappointing. SourceForge was one of the coolest places on the internet.
Yeah, I was sad, especially since SourceForge has built itself up on the backs of open source.
Right.
And I really don't think this kind of behavior is in keeping with the spirit of open source.
Yeah. Oh, definitely not. Yeah.
So anyway, that's
all right. Okay, we'll clean our palate by talking about more malware.
Well, malware is an interesting word for it. So there is a whole kerfuffle around what Verizon are doing and AT&T are playing with, which has gotten the name permacookies, but they're not cookies.
Okay.
So what Verizon are doing and AT&T are experimenting with is injecting a unique identifier into HTTP headers as they pass from you through their servers to the internet. So this is if you're using those companies as cellular providers.
Okay, so I'm on cellular data, and I surf to podfeet.com. Something's going to come in between me and that traffic.
Yes, it's going to intercept the request your browser sends, add in an extra header with a unique identifier, and then pass that on to the website.
So unique identifier meaning identifying me or identifying...
It's a unique identifier that identifies you. Now, only Verizon know that it's you, but it stays the same as you browse from site to site to site. So ad networks can use it to tie you together.
Okay.
So if you visit PayPal, if you visit, say, Amazon, and you look at something, and then you visit something else that uses Amazon's ad network, it ties those two together. Then you log into Twitter. Oh, Twitter can now tie all this together. And so because the same ID follows you everywhere, all of the snippets of information can be sewn together. Oh, this username matches this username. Great, I now know that.
How is this different than regular old cookies? I thought regular cookies could do that, no?
Regular cookies can do that, but regular cookies involve your browser accepting the cookie, and so if you have plugins to protect yourself, you can protect yourself. This is being inserted by your ISP, who is a man in the middle. They're leveraging, or I would say abusing, a position of power to tamper with your data for the purpose of tracking you. I mean, they're injecting a unique identifier into your data. They are altering your web requests. To me, that's malicious activity.
Yeah, if it weren't from your ISP, that is exactly what we would call it.
Correct. And I love the Orwellian word that the advertising industry have come up for this. Header enrichment.
You know, you really got to respect the people. I hope those people are paid a lot of money who come up with those names, right?
Yeah. I don't know.
Like right-sizing?
Right,
otherwise known as layoffs?
Yes. I believe there's a circle of hell just for those people. I detest Newspeak. It's evil.
What does one do about this? I mean, is anybody fighting this?
Well,
should we tweet angrily?
The EFF are obviously... Unsurprisingly, the EFF were on board. Actually, there's a really good blog post from the EFF linked in the show notes, so you can go and read. And they describe basically what it is, what the problem is, and what they feel Verizon should do. So the real downside here is, so Verizon insert these IDs, and they can then use that to tie it to you, the customer, and then they can sell your profile to advertisers. But you can opt out of having your profile sold. But opting out of having your profile sold doesn't remove the injection into your headers. So as far as all those third parties are concerned, they can continue to track you because they continue to see this unique ID.
Well, how are you opted out if you're still in?
Well, they're not selling it. So you're opting out of being sold by Verizon. Verizon are just making you available to everyone by accident, really.
So all you're doing is keeping them from making money from your data, but the data is still going?
Well, the data isn't going. The ID is still being inserted. So all the third parties can just read them as you visit websites.
Huh.
And if you want to know whether or not you're being... So this is just a HTTP header. It's called x-uidh. And I've written a tiny little Perl script that just prints out all of the headers your browser sends to my server, or rather all of the headers my server receives, whether they were sent by your browser or by a third party in the middle. And so the link is just bartb.ie/headers. And if you go to that from your computer, you'll see that there's no x-bloody-blah header at all in there. It's all just normal stuff. Might be a cookie or two, probably not actually for most people. There is for me because I'm logged into my own blog. You know, just the usual stuff your browser sends.
So I see accept language, accept encoding, connection accept, host, user agent.
Yes. And you'll notice they all start with HTTP underscore. So anything that's part of the standard starts with HTTP underscore. And anything that's added on by someone else starts with X underscore, which is why it's X UI.
Oh,
blah.
Okay.
And so you'll see there's no X anything in there, and it's all fine. But if you were to get a Verizon cell phone, stick it onto cellular service, you could see the header they're inserting.
Okay. And they're already doing that to everybody, but AT&T is experimenting with the concept?
Well, AT&T aren't selling anything to anyone, but they have that turned on, according to reports. So people are seeing the header inside their traffic.
So
the damage is done.
I just went to bartb.ie/headers on my iPhone, which is on AT&T, and I do not see any of that X stuff.
Good. Then, obviously, the trial is not nationwide, which is good.
But I also have a Verizon device I could use here.
Okie dokie.
We could check it. So it should happen on the Verizon device?
It should happen on the Verizon device, assuming they have this rolled out to every, you know, all of their network.
Right.
Because they have to stick devices into, you know, the places where all of your traffic comes together to actually inject these headers. And there's not one place in the whole country where everyone's traffic goes, so it's obviously going to have to be rolled out place to place to place.
Right. Now, one thing I would say, I'm not very good at being an activist on this sort of topic. I'm activist-like on other things, but what I do appreciate is when someone's doing it on my behalf. So if this sounds as creepy to you as it does to me, and you're happy that the EFF is working on this, maybe go throw them $20. You know,
I would wholeheartedly agree. They send you nice T-shirts if you donate the right amount.
Well, apparently I haven't given enough, but I do from time to time go, yeah, that's a worthy effort. Here's some money. You know, keep at it. And that seems to, I feel good that they're working it and they're working for me because I helped, contribute.
I think I only got stickers this year, but last year I donated a bit more and got a t-shirt.
Oh, cool. So I just checked it on my Verizon device. I turned off Wi-Fi before I did it and it didn't find anything.
Okay, well, that's good. I'm hoping it's not. No, that's good. That's good.
Okay.
This is happening to people in certain parts of the country. And as it gets rolled out to more, unless Verizon pulled the stick on the brakes, it is going to start to happen to more and more people.
Yeah.
Again, you can see if it's happening to you by visiting that URL. It's just, no, it's just like a mirror for HTTP headers. It just bounces back whatever it gets. The other somewhat disturbing thing is, so I'm saying that in theory, third parties can leverage this data, but that's not actually theory, because ProPublica are reporting that Twitter's advertising arm are doing it already.
How are they leveraging it?
Because they can see that header and they can start to tie information together.
Okay.
And so that is an example of an ad network that is already basically using Verizon to do their job for them. Which is, it's very convenient if you're running an advertising network.
So again, we're going to call this one medium because the only thing you can pretty much do right now is give some money to the EFF to fight it, right?
No, that's not so. So I think you rightly said that this is a bit like what we'd expect at an internet cafe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's exactly how you should think of it. You now need to see Verizon as being a malicious agent intercepting your traffic. So how would you stop someone in the coffee shop intercepting your traffic?
With my VPN, but my VPN doesn't look at the cellular signal that
Why
I know of.
Why can't you send... I'm pretty sure you can enable VPNs over cellular.
So Cloak is what I use, and Cloak automatically looks for unsecure or untrusted networks. So if I haven't actively trusted a network, it will not trust it.
A regular VPN like OpenVPN is just something you turn on or off. It will secure your connection regardless of whether you're going over a cell phone or over wireless. It will just secure it. So I don't know if Cloak's app can do cell phone connections or not, but certainly VPNs in the generic sense can.
Hmm. That's exhausting, Bart.
I'm sorry. But anyway, that's
I know you didn't do it.
Yeah, I know. So that's that, and then we can move into regular security light. So a good news story. Do you remember a couple of weeks back there was a kerfuffle about Adobe's Digital Editions e-reader sending information about what you were reading unencrypted over the internet?
Yes.
Well, they promised they would fix it. They have fixed it. So good news. If you run Digital Editions, update. Other security news, good news, Google have started offering a USB security.
I just read in Cloak how to trust cellular networks. It says in general, cellular networks tend to be secure, and Cloak can, it lets you decide whether you trust cellular networks or not. You can change the setting from within trusted networks.
There you go. So in that case, that is your answer. And then all of your traffic is encrypted. And also, actually, just one last thing to say on that is this, it's impossible for a man in the middle to tinker with HTTPS traffic, so it is just HTTP traffic.
Oh, okay.
Which is a lot of your traffic, but at least they can't get into the secured stream. So anyway, VPN on, problem solved.
Wow. Okay.
Okay, so Digital Editions has been patched. Google have started offering a USB security device. So this is really the ultimate, you know, how not to have a password, have a cryptographic device that you take with you and that it proves you are you. And so this is a tiny little thing that sits into your USB drive and identifies you to Google services. Great idea, good crypto behind it, but it requires the browser to know how to talk to the crypto device, which means it works on Chrome now, but nothing else.
It also means it's got to only be on a Mac or a PC or a Chromebook, can't be on an iPad or an Android tablet.
Yeah, you have to be able to shove the USB thing into it and... the browser has to be able to talk to the USB thing. So at the moment, it's a Chrome-only thing. But if you're bought into the Google ecosystem and you have your Chromebook and you're using Chrome as your regular browser, this is a pretty cool idea.
So how is this any different from a YubiKey? And I'll explain to the audience what a YubiKey is. It's a little thumb device or a USB device that you press a button on, which causes the device to actually type in the unique password for that moment in time. It's connected back to the servers, and it's a rotating key kind of thing, and it's connected up, and it provides that information. How is this different from that?
It's not a keyboard, so it doesn't behave in that way. It does different cryptography, and it's sort of a challenge response thing. So basically, Steve Gibson went into the whole details of it. I didn't really study it that hard, but the idea is that the server on the far side and this device do a little bit of a chatter over and back, and that proves cryptographically they are who they say they are. But it's not as simple as typing a password.
It sounds functionally about the same.
Except for the fact that there's no password box that there's something being shoved into, so it's functionally quite different, actually. Because if there was a text box to type in, then you could arguably work around it somehow, but it
sounds a lot more limited to me than using a YubiKey. I mean, because it only works with the one browser, and
it's also a lot cheaper than a YubiKey.
Yeah, but you're talking still in the under $50 kind of range for both of them.
I think you're talking about $19, according to what I had read.
Right, but I don't think the other isn't over $50 either.
No, but it's closer.
Well, yeah, so is $20.
No, but I don't have the prices here to hand, but I thought we were talking about the $40-ish mark for a YubiKey.
Yeah, so, I mean,
half price.
Yeah.
Ish.
But less than half is capable. Standard is right. $25.
Okay, that's...
So 19 versus 25. That's not a material
not a
amount of money. You can pay... Oh, wait, there's the FIDO UTF special security key for $18. I don't know what that one does. You can get the premium Neo-N for $60.
Well, FIDO is what this protocol is. And now the other thing, of course, is so if you get a YubiKey, it can spit out one password so it can protect one service. This key can protect any website that speaks FIDO. This is not a one-service thing. So the YubiKey is very much like the... Do you remember the old RSA dongles people used to carry around? Where there would be a code that changes every 30 seconds.
Right.
Well, the YubiKey is basically one of those as a keyboard, so you don't have to type.
Exactly.
So it can keep track of one changing key, so it can protect one thing. Whereas this FIDO thing is designed that there's an API around it and et cetera. So that identity, you can match that identity to lots of different things. Google are just the first to have it in their browser and the first to have it in their services.
So these
but
are
FIDO
really
is an
second
open,
factor authentication, though. They're not... in place of using passwords.
Okay, but it's a pretty solid two-factor authentication.
Right. Oh, yeah, no, I'm not saying it isn't. I'm just looking at the FIDO UTF from YubiKey stands for Universal Second Factor. So for $18, you can get one from YubiKey that I would presume works on more than Chrome.
Yeah, so basically FIDO is this protocol that hopefully is going to take off. I mean, Google running with it is a pretty good way to make it take off.
Yeah. Do you think you're going to get one?
No, because I need my iPhone to work kind of a lot. I might get one to play with. I also hate Chrome. So
other than that, well, try this YubiKey one.
Yeah, well, no, because a YubiKey isn't going to work with stuff that doesn't talk YubiKey.
No. Their FIDO version. They've got a FIDO UTF for $18.
Okay, but what service do I have?
I don't know.
That would mean I'd need to be using Chrome on something that right now means Chrome.
You're saying only Chrome speaks UTF?
Yeah, so far.
Or FIDO. Okay, I got you. Okay, so it wouldn't do you any good. It's a dollar cheaper, though.
Yeah, but if I had a Chromebook and if I was in, you know, if I was as invested in Google's ecosystem as I am in Apple's ecosystem, my ears would have pricked up.
Yeah.
But they didn't.
Okay.
Anyway, I thought it was worth mentioning because if this takes off, this is very good.
Yeah.
There's a privilege escalation bug in OS X. Really, the bottom line is Apple know about it. There will be a patch coming out. The only people this affects are people who run as admin, which the reason I put it in the show notes is because it ties nicely back to George's discussion a few weeks ago.
Yeah, you know, I just set up my mother-in-law with her new Mac Mini, and I sat there looking at that initial thing saying, do I make her an admin or not? And I was like, I don't know what the questions are going to be like, so I'm going to make her an admin so I don't have to know. Sorry, George.
Oh, well. Anyway, this is privilege escalation. So in order for an attacker to use it, they would have to already have gotten in some other way. So it's the kind of bug that makes existing attacks worse.
Mm.
But they still have to get in before they can escalate their privileges.
Oh, okay.
So it's not good, but it's not hair on fire.
The sky isn't falling completely.
Correct.
Okay.
Just in case anyone didn't yet get the message that the MD5 hash is dead as some dodos, you can now create a hash collision for 65 cent worth of computing time on Amazon EC2.
So I listened to you a lot and I didn't understand any of the words you just said.
Okay, so the whole point of a hash...
No, I knew what hash was, but that was the only thing. Go ahead.
Okay, so if you want to attack something that's hashed, one way to attack it is to intentionally create different data that hashes to the same thing. If you don't know someone's password, but you can make something hashed to the same hash as their password, it's effectively their password.
Right. Okay.
So hash collisions are very, very bad things.
What's a hash collision?
So when you get two different inputs with the same hash.
Oh, is that possible?
Yes, if you think about it. So you can take the Encyclopedia Britannica and hash it down to 128 bits. So you
wait. You're saying two different things can go into this potato masher and turn into the exact same thing.
Yes, that is always possible because there's only 128 bits or whatever, or 256 bits in a hash, and there's like an infinity of the universe out there of things you could hash. So by definition, some of them hash to the same thing, but it should be impossible to find them.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, like the chance of finding them should be equivalent to the age of the universe, kind of thing.
Okay.
For a hash to be a good hash,
the old needle in the haystack thing.
Exactly.
Okay.
Like serious, teeny tiny needle, very big haystack thing.
Okay.
Right, one atom universe kind of thing. But MD5 is now so broken that you can run an algorithm that will find a collision, and it will cost you, if you do it on Amazon's cloud computer, it will cost you 65 cents worth of compute time.
Huh. And I thought MD5 was one of the good ones. Did it used to be one of the good ones?
It used to be ubiquitous.
That's not the same as answering my question, is it?
No, it was best practice.
Okay.
Some time ago. It's quite some time ago. MD5, I'm afraid, hasn't been trusted for quite some time. That's why we switched to SHA-1, which you now are starting to lose faith in, which is why we're switching to SHA-2.
Okay. What does this mean to the Nocella castaways?
Maybe that should have been then a suggested reading now that I look at it.
Okay, well, I had fun learning about it.
I'm putting this in here in case any of our listeners use Drupal to run their websites.
Okay.
So we sometimes do this for WordPress problems, but this one is like a doozy. So Drupal actually released what they called a public service announcement, saying that if you didn't patch your Drupal within 7 hours of them releasing Drupal 7.3.2 on the 15th of October, you should consider your site hacked, because it probably is.
Ooh.
So nice. Just hours after the update, automated attacks started happening and botnets basically started hacking Drupal sites all over the place.
Oh, jeez.
And the other thing they point out is, once you've been hacked, applying the patch doesn't solve the problem. You have closed the barn door, but the horse is tootled off.
Wow.
So this is really bad if you have Drupal and you haven't patched.
So right now we're telling them, just go start crying in a corner.
You need to go find a backup from the day before this came out.
Ah.
And restore from that.
Okay.
And I know there are a lot of sysadmins doing that.
Yeah. Bummer.
Yes.
All right.
And then just finally an anecdote for anyone who says, but why should we encrypt our phones? I'm afraid the police in your neck of the woods, the California Highway Patrol, were caught sharing pictures they had taken from pretty girls' phones.
Ew.
Yes.
Ew.
Home Depot lost 53 million email addresses as well as 56 million payment card details. Somehow the payment card details seem scarier, but it's still not good. So, and then there's all...
I did find it interesting when I was hanging out with my mother-in-law this weekend, working on her Mac and everything. We drove over to a store and I asked her whether she had heard of Apple Pay, and she said, yeah, I have heard of that. And she said, did you hear that Home Depot's now lost a bunch of email addresses on top of the credit cards they lost? And doesn't this Apple Pay thing supposed to be a lot more secure, right? How does it work? I was like, yes! Right? Yeah, it was awesome. But I think this information is getting into the mainstream, not because, again, Apple is the first to anything, but because they're making it mainstream.
Yeah, well, there's a story doing the rounds that usage of Google Pay has skyrocketed since the launch of Apple Pay.
I would bet it is, because all of a sudden you're like, wait, I had that?
Yeah, which is great. You know, the more people doing this, the better, because tokenized credit cards are a lot safer than credit cards.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty interesting that it's that mainstream. I mean, my mother-in-law is very clever and pays attention. So, but this is a mainstream, you know, muggle who knows what's going on.
She's not reading Ars Technica every morning.
No, I don't think so. A little more muggle than that, but she's clever and all.
Yeah. There is lots of stuff on suggested reading, but we've gone on more than long enough, so I'm just going to leave all to people's initiative, whatever you want to say.
All right. Now, you promised me that we would do a recap.
Yes. And this recap is going to have a slight alteration in it, because I made a little bit of a boo-boo. Not a very big boo-boo, but a very small boo-boo in the first run-through of this.
I do want to say first, we got a lot of fantastic feedback on this. People really, really enjoyed the network segment, Bart. And I think sometimes taming the terminal is best for people who actually already know a lot about the terminal, and they learn a little bit more each time, or they like hearing what they already know. But this was one that was helpful to a lot more people, I think.
Yeah, because there was a lot of feedback on your Google Plus group, and I think on your website. But I've also had feedback from people directly. So yeah, it definitely caught people's attention.
Yeah, and even in my own house.
Oh, well, that's good.
Steve loved it. He said it was really, really good, really interesting to learn. So, but I do need a refresher.
Okay. Well, first off, just to say that I made a slight mistake describing how UDP worked, and listener Matthew Miller was very kind to point out my whoopsie. So I have corrected the show notes, so they are now correct. And when we get to that bit, I'll just correct myself in detail.
Okay, good.
So what we talked about last time was that all of our internet, all of our networking that we do is made go by TCP/IP. That is what makes our computers talk to each other within our house, and what makes our house talk to the internet.
Mm-hmm.
It's all TCP/IP. And it's a stack of protocols, and communication is always adjacent stack to adjacent stack, so you never get to skip anything.
Right.
You always talk to the person next to you in the stack. Sort of like think of it like a bucket chain putting out a fire.
You know, no cutsies.
Person to person.
Yeah. Okay.
For the sake of understanding how this massive, I mean, there's a lot of these protocols, but for the sake of understanding how they all hang together, we've broken the problem to be solved into four chunks, which we call layers, or network abstraction layers. And each layer solves a different problem, and the layers are stacked just like the protocols are. Excuse me. So at the very, very bottom, you have the link layer. And its job is to get one little packet of data from one computer to another computer on the same network. And at that level, the protocol that rules the roost is Ethernet. And that means that at layer one, it's MAC addresses. So a packet of information from this MAC address to that MAC address is what's going on.
So the link layer is where Ethernet lives?
Yes.
Okay.
The next layer up is the internet layer, which takes us to the next step, and it gets one packet of information from any computer on any network to any other computer on any other network connected to it via the internet or via some other network connection. And so internet, because it's inter-network, and the protocol that rules the roost at the internet layer is the IP protocol, which stands for the Internet Protocol. And IP traffic is IP address to IP address.
Got it.
IP addresses rule the roost at layer two. Layer three is the transport layer. And so all of these layers so far have been an individual packet, and all of those packets are delivered on a best effort basis. And if the packet goes missing, yeah, well, so be it. And the packets could arrive in any order. You know, they're sent in one order, but they're each independent. Some of them might go left, some of them might go right a few times over. And the order is not guaranteed when they get to the other end. So to put some sort of order on top of the chaos below, we have the transport layer. And the transport layer introduces the concept of port numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. The transport layer takes port number plus IP address to port number plus IP address. And the two protocols that rule the roost in there are the UDP, the Unified Datagram Protocol, and TCP, the Transmission Control Protocol. And last time I gave UDP too much credit. UDP actually is even dumber than I described it. And I already described it as being quite dumb. UDP is a really, really thin wrapper around IP. UDP takes a single packet, or a datagram as UDP calls it, from one port number on one IP address and tries its best to deliver it to another port number on another IP address, but it may go missing. And that's it. That's all UDP does. the applications that use UDP will generally be tolerant of this. So they understand that UDP is a bit wobbly and they understand that packets can arrive out of order. And so it's not UDP that throws away the packets that come in the wrong order. It's actually Skype or VLC whatever. So UDP does very, very, very little. And it's the apps using UDP are responsible for deciding what to do.
Just out of curiosity, did you know this and made a mistake, or did you learn this because of the help from Matthew Miller?
The latter. That's
even cooler, right?
It is, yeah. So basically, I had drawn the line between what the application does and what UDP does a little too high. I had assumed UDP was more powerful than it was.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Which is good. So, I now know more about UDP. And then TCP is the one that's the real workhorse of the internet. So UDP is... it's very, very low resource. It takes very little effort to do so little, which is why it's great for streaming, because there's no overhead and it's just very responsive. And it's also why it's used for DNS, because DNS servers have so much work to do, it would just take far too much CPU and RAM to do things with TCP. But TCP is what makes most of the world go. And TCP manages to not only get rid of the fact that packets go missing, it also puts them back in the right order. And so if you take 2 terabytes of data in one end of a TCP connection and shove it through, the same 2 terabytes will come out the other end and it'll all be correct.
That was my favorite thing last week. Really? That's crazy.
It is crazy. And it does it by a whole bunch of magic, basically very clever use of buffers and an awful lot of talking over and back. And I didn't mention it last week, but it's actually, if you use something like menu meters to watch your internet traffic, and if you download a large file, you'll notice it's never, the traffic is not all one way. You'd see like, you know, 1, 2 or 3 megs
yeah.
down and a few K up.
I have
those few
that.
K up are TCP chattering over and back. Got so, that much, send me the next bit. Got that much, send me the next bit. Ooh, that packet's missing, send it to me again. And that chatter is taking up those few kilobytes in the opposite direction.
Oh, interesting. That's what that is.
Yes. And so that's sort of where that's almost where we left it. So what I then said was, so in terms of the physicality of a packet of information, it travels down, 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 down the layers all the way to the physical layer. And once it hits the physical layer, that's when it moves from one device to another. And if that second device is a router, it'll come back up as far as the IP layer. The router will figure out what to do with it. And then back down to the link layer it goes, and it gets shoved off to the next router. It gets lifted up to the IP layer, dropped back down to the link layer and shoved around the internet. And eventually it lands on your computer when it ripples all the way back up through all the layers to whatever it was that was communicating in the first place. So physically, the packet goes down the stack until it hits the link layer, and then it goes across to the next computer. And then all it can do is go up and down the stack, because the only time you can move left or right is when you're at the bottom layer.
Oh, right. Because everybody's got to pass to the one next to them.
Right. So the only time you move computer to computer is when you're at the lowest layer, and then you can go up and down the stack within a computer.
Okay.
But in terms of the logic, from the end user's point of view, layers talk straight across to each other. So HTTP talks to HTTP on the other side. Now, HTTP actually uses TCP to make that happen, but logically, TCP is talking to TCP on the other side. To make that happen, it's talking IP and all the way down. So from your point of view as an end user, you talk straight across the stack. You're not allowed to go diagonal. Mm-hmm. It has to be straight. HTTP to HTTP, IMAP to IMAP, SMTP.
You're saying that's what it feels like, but that's not really what's happening.
Exactly. So from a logical... how I use it point of view, that's how you think of it. From a physical point of view, it's down, 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 across, up, 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 up.
It's amazing that's so fast.
It is. Well, computers are quick, right?
Well, and networks and...
right, but actually our computers, our little network cards, actually have little tiny computers inside them that take care of the computing involved in TCP and save your actual CPU from having to do that.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking more of the data going up and down and up and down and over and back and forth. That's a lot of traffic, too.
It is, but that's what computers do. Yeah. Like they shove ones and zeros around pipes. and there's a lot of it for networking.
Okay.
Well, if you ever stood behind the switch in a corporation, there's a lot of heat comes out of the back of those.
Yeah, there is.
Which tells you they're doing a lot of computing.
Right. I always thought it was math. It sounds like it's just, playing cards.
Well, there is some math involved, right? Because we haven't talked about how the IP layer manages to do the magic trick of figuring out how to connect any 2 points on the internet together.
Yeah.
Because what a puzzle to solve.
Yeah, yeah.
And, it can do that, but there's actually some computing involved there. And there's, you know, there's whole bunches of algorithms. So there's chitter-chatter going between routers purely for the point of the routers educating their friends. That's actually how it works. So the routers tell their friends what they know, and everyone builds up a picture of the internet by asking their mates what they know. Right, so you know, you're a router, and you say, does anyone know where Twitter is? And you know, the guy to your left says, oh, yeah, I know how to get to Twitter. He doesn't tell you anything more than, I know how to, and then you just pass it to him, and then he goes, so you said you know how to get to Twitter, I'll give it to you. Oh, you said you know how to get to Twitter, and eventually it gets to Twitter.
That's magic.
Anyway, so I said we'd try to work through an example to make this a bit more practical and to throw in some terminal commands so we can watch a little bit of what's going on. And so to do that, we're going to pick a very, very, very straightforward example. And we're going to start at the application layer because that's where everything starts for us as humans. We're going to go to a browser and we're going to type in a URL.
Okie dokie.
And we're going to follow it through its magic. And so the URL in question is so-4pt.net/tildebart/TTT23.
Okay, did anybody type that as fast as he typed it, just said it? What is it again?
I was going to say it's in the show notes for copy-paste purposes. I should make that a quick
but
link.
I haven't been reading the show notes. I've actually been listening. So-4p.net.
4pt.
4pt.net.
/TildeBart.
Okay.
/TTT for taming the terminal.
Okay.
23.
Okay.
It's a very dumb page.
Hello, terminal tamer. I hope you're enjoying this series thus far. Bart.
Right? Not the world's most exciting webpage, but nonetheless...
I kind of liked it.
We have talked HTTP from our browser to my web server, which means that your computer talked TCP to my web server, which means it was IP and all the way down the stack. So let's just follow it.
Okay.
So before you visit any URL, some digital ducks have to be put in a row on my end, right? So for you to visit my webpage, I must have created said webpage.
Mm-hmm.
So... I need to have arranged for a DNS server somewhere to advertise to the world that so-4pt.net has the IP address 42.22.130.125. And I have to have put a computer there which has that IP address, and I have to have configured an application to be a web server.
Right.
In this case, it's the Apache web server, if you're curious. So I have all of those ducks in a row. So that piece of software that is my web server is sitting on an operating system. Happens to be Linux. And it has told the operating system, if a packet arrives over TCP on port 80, it's for me. And in the jargon, we say that the web server is listening on port 80 for TCP. So it's a contract between the operating system and the app. So the app has said, dear operating system, port 80, TCP, that's for me.
Okay.
And so when a packet arrives on port 80, the operating system knows... which application it should hand it to.
Which operating system? My operating system or the operating system of your server?
So this is all on my server. So my server is my web server app, Apache, has said to my Linux operating system, port 80 on TCP is for me.
Okay.
And so if anyone makes a TCP connection to my server on port 80, the OS knows which app to hand that to, which is my web server. And then it can go do the HTTP thing. So that's how we get the handoff between layers 3 and 4.
Okay.
So you just tell the OS, hello, it's me. So your browser... Okay, so you're going to assume that I have put all of my ducks in a row, which is obvious because the web page worked. And so you type that into the address bar and you hit enter. So the first thing is that your browser talks to web servers using the HTTP protocol. So the first thing your browser does is it assembles what's called a HTTP request. And this ties back very nicely to this week's show because these are the things that Verizon are injecting. So you'll see that the HTTP request takes the form command, URL, version of HTTP, and then some headers. And so they're the same headers you would have seen before, user agent, accept language, accept encoding. Yeah.
Okay.
So your browser just creates this based on the URL. So you'll see there, I've actually grabbed it. There's lovely developer tools in Safari. So this is actually the genuine header from my computer.
I don't know where you are. I'm just seeing, hello, Terminal Tamer. Am I supposed to be looking back at the show notes?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I have no idea where we are in the show notes. Like I said, I was listening, not reading.
We're on the blue box that starts with the word get in all capitals.
Blue box, get.
So the section is putting it all together, and then you scroll down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 paragraphs or so.
Ah, Okay. Yeah, I highly recommend reading his show notes while he talks.
especially for this one.
Okay.
So you'll see there that your browser has taken you typing the URL and turned it into HTTP. So the HTTP protocol, therefore.
How do you know it's doing all this? This get BART TTT 23?
Well, because Safari's developer tools let you see the headers. So I just went to Safari, show me the request. And Safari went, here's what I sent to your server.
Oh.
So this is actually what Safari sent to my server. Which okay. is great. And the other reason I know how to talk HTTP is because I kind of have to for my work.
Okay. So normal humans are not expected to be doing this.
No. The point is, your browser is talking HTTP, which is a very high-level language, right? That's not... Okay. There's not even an IP address in here, right?
Okay.
It just says, I want this URL on the server. So you see get and then the URL. And it wants it on the server so-4pt.net. And it's sending on some extra information to help the server.
Okay.
User agent is what browser you are, what language you'd like to speak. Just some fluff, right? Okay. But there's nothing, there's no IP addresses, there's no port numbers, there's nothing low level. This is a very high level conversation because HTTP is way up there in layer 4.
Right.
So your browser assembles this HTTP request, and then it says to your operating system on your Mac, it says, I need to send this over to BART's web server. But before it can even ask that question, it has to ask your operating system a more fundamental question. Dear operating system, what IP address is so-4pt.net?
Okay. It asks my operating system that?
Yes, because your browser uses your operating system to do everything.
Okay, so
your
browser, and then my operating system is going to talk to my ISP or whoever I've set up in my router to use my DNS servers.
Correct. Now, we're going to revisit DNS, and so not to confuse things, I am making the assumption that your OS has it cached, which is true now because you visited the site once.
Okay. Just in case we haven't said it out loud lately, DNS is domain name servers, and that's the conversion from the name you type in, bartb.ie, into an IP address.
Correct. So in this case, your operating system has answered back to your browser, so-4pt.net maps the IP address 46.22.130.125.
Okay.
Your browser then says to your OS, Dear macOS 10, I would like to start talking TCP to this IP address on port 80, please. And I want you to shove through that TCP connection this HTTP request. And your operating system then talks to itself. It's a little bit schizophrenic. So your operating system has many selves. Your operating system's TCP self says to your operating system's IP self, yeah, I need to talk IP. I need to get a message across to that guy over there, to that IP address. It then hands down to your network card, which does the whole layer one thing. And the packet moves across, all the ripples down through all the layers within your operating system, gets handed to your network card. If you're using Wi-Fi, the network card beams it out as radio waves. If you're using a twisted pair, it sends it out as little electrical signals. Gets to your router. Your router receives it as an Ethernet packet, lifts it up into your router's IP layer, mm-hmm. and your router looks at it and goes, okay, so the destination IP address is 46 dot blah, 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 blah. Well, that's not inside this house. Therefore, the only other thing I can do with it is send it out to the ISP. And so your router sends it out to your ISP's router.
Okay.
And it puts it back down to cable modem language, sends it through the cable modem. It pops up in your ISP's router. As cable modem talk, your ISP's router translates that up to layer one again. It looks at it and goes, that IP address. Ah, I know, that's that-a-way. Down, physically across the next router, pops up. It looks at the packet again and goes, ah, okay, over there. Eventually, it rattles along and it rattles along and it rattles along. And eventually, it arrives at the router in my hosting provider. And the routing in my hosting provider picks it up to its layer one, looks at it and goes, ah, I know you. You're on my network. And it drops it into its own network, but again, it drops it back down to layer one. It knows my MAC address of my server, and it sends it to that MAC address of my server. My server's operating system now collects it, and it ripples up through all the layers, and it gets handed to my web server process.
So you're saying every hop that my traffic makes on its way from Los Angeles to Ireland, it's
Correct.
Going all the way down through the layers to the MAC address of the server that it's hit and back up again.
Yes, but it only goes all the way up at the two endpoints. In between, it's only going up as far as layer one or layer two.
Just the IP traffic layer.
Yeah.
Okay, to
so
the
it goes
internet
down
layer.
To
okay.
link, up to IP, down to link, up to IP. So it's sort of like a W with lots of middle humps.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's astonishing.
Every packet. And if
I really feel like I'm wasting the internet with the screwing around I do. You know, you watching a cat video, just think how hard these things are working.
Right, but there are a lot of packets being sent. A lot of packets, and routers do like spectacular amounts of work.
Yeah, we just sent text.
Yeah, so this ripples all the way back up, and eventually my operating system on my server hands it to my web server process, which looks at it and goes, ah, I speak HTTP. Ah, you want that file over there. It goes to the hard drive, finds the HTML file that matches to that URL, which is a very simple HTML file, and it uses that HTML file to assemble what's called the HTTP response, which is the second part of the HTTP protocol. And so the actual response I have in the show notes, and this is exact as it was sent, because again, Safari lets you see the response headers too. So you'll see it comes back and it says HTTP 1.1 200 OK. Now, you don't know that you know HTTP response codes, but you do. If I say to you 401.
That's a bad one. The file not found.
Right. 200 OK is what you don't see, because 200 OK means everything's fine.
Okay.
But that's actually where that comes from. It comes from the first line of a HTTP response.
Huh.
The other evil one is 500, internal server error.
Yeah, I don't like that one.
502, bad gateway. Don't like those either. 301 is good. It's a redirect. 302 is another redirect. That's where they are.
I've seen 301 in the redirect stuff you gave me that lets us go from puffy.com/Google+ actually takes you to googleplus.com/blah, blah, 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 blah.
Correct. So 301 is a permanent redirect. 302 is a temporary redirect.
Hmm.
So anyway, so the server responds with a HTTP response. The first line is telling the browser, I'm about to tell you about this error, or I'm about to give you a file, or I'm about to tell you where else to go. So the first line tells the browser how to interpret all the rest. And so 200 OK is what the browser wants. It means this web server was able to answer my question. It then gives a bunch of headers, which the browser can use to decide how to cache things and a few other bits and bobs. So it says the date it was generated, a whole bunch of other gobs. And the important thing is it tells the browser what it's handing it back. In this case, content-type text/HTML UTF-8. Very important, because if I was sending an image, the browser would have to know these ones and zeros are a JPEG. These ones and zeros are a PIF, or a PNG.
Okay.
So it's all in here. And then after an empty line, so the way the HTTP protocol works is you tell it HTTP header, sorry, the response line, your headers, empty line, the data. So if that was a JPEG, the empty line and then a whole bunch of ones and zeros, in this case it's empty line followed by some HTML. And that's actually that entire web page. So head, title, blah, blah, blah. Not a very common, complicated web page.
I think
and
I
your browser
it.
Just takes that information and puts it on the screen.
Huh. Yeah, this really makes me not believe in the internet anymore, because I don't believe this can possibly be going on. This is way a lot of work.
It is going on, and it's going on thousands and thousands of times a second. So
yeah, I don't
we
believe planes can fly either, though, Bart. So,
well, and yet you've been to Ireland. We can have a look, actually, and see what's going on. Maybe that'll help you believe.
Okay.
If I show you more. So I think we mentioned in passing that there's a couple of other protocols that share layer 2, and one of them allows for sort of troubleshooting. But there's a fantastic protocol that allows you to see all the routers between you and the endpoint. The command is called traceroute, or if you're on Windows, it's trace or T.
Okay.
And so if you pop up a little terminal window there.
Uh-huh.
And if you type traceroute space minus N space and then the IP address of my server, which is 46.22.130.125.
So you can't do it with a name?
You can, but we're talking here about, you know, we're describing what's actually happening. So under the hood, IP connections are IP addresses.
Okay.
So it's more authentic.
Okay. It's hopping.
Now, it's normal to find a couple of empty lines. What that means is that there is a router there, but it's not being communicative.
Hmm.
It's not sending back metadata. So this actually uses something very like a ping. But it uses a ping with a time to live of one hop and then waits for it to come back. And then it sends one with two hops and then with three hops and then with four hops. And so it'll take a little minute because it's basically doing lots of pings to lots of routers to see where they are and how far they're going, and eventually you should land on my server. Now, I'm in Ireland, and my server is in Ireland. So for me, it's 12 hops.
I'm getting 16. But that also, by the way, that includes the first hop is to my my Airport Extreme. And my second hop is to my Verizon router that we have bypassed. So I've got two extras in there probably, or at least one extra.
Well, you got, yeah, so everyone is going to have their home router, but you and I both have two extra because my setup is the same as yours.
Right, okay.
So those first two, in my case, are 192.168. Yeah. And then I'm onto the internet, and my ISP is two empty hops that aren't showing, and then we're bouncing around the internet until we land on my server, 12 hops later for me, 16 hops later for you.
Now, they're in lists. Like, I'm noticing some of them, like when I get to step 8, it's the same first three sets of numbers. So 152.63.114, it goes to .221.229.225. Why would it do that?
You're probably ricocheting around within a network that belongs to the same company. So if you can imagine that a large company, and I have no idea who that IP address belongs to, but hypothetically a large company like Verizon.
Oh, okay.
Would own an awful lot of networking equipment throughout the United States. And they would have bought one giant big chunk of IP addresses, which they would use for all of their routers. And so that could those three hops could be you crossing your whole country.
Huh. But they're all within one. Each number is a hop, right? 1 through 16.
Yes.
So they're all within a single hop. When I'm seeing
so each one of those is a hop. So those three IP addresses that look the same could be, say, it could arrive in New York where it comes up out of the ground from Ireland, and then it might jump you the whole way as far as Los Angeles, and then it might jump you to, I don't know, some place that's like 500 yards from your door, and then it jumps you to your house.
Right, but I'm saying within one of those hops, it's going to three servers that have the first three sets of digits the same.
Right, so that's three routers probably belonging to the same company.
Yeah.
But if you think about it...
But why aren't those separate hops?
Well, because they're different routers. So every time you come up from
Why aren't they separate hops? They're not shown as separate hops.
It means that they're coming up from layer one to a router.
Okay. So they're moving between routers.
They're moving between routers. Every time you see something here, it has popped up to a router. So in other words, it arrived at someone's router who's went, yeah, the closest way is to go to that other router that we own as well. And it gets whooshed over there.
But it's not considered a hop.
Every line here is a hop.
Okay, then I don't have 16 hops. I have way more hops because I've got
okay, it wasn't finished yet. Okay.
No. I'm saying it was finished. I'm saying within hop 14, it has three servers. Within hop 15, that one doesn't count. Within hop 8, there's three different servers.
That's unusual. That means that there's three different options. Okay, what that means, I don't see that on mine. It's interesting you see it on yours, but that actually, I believe what that means is that there are three different possible routes to go that step. And so you're seeing all three of the possibles.
Yeah. Just for grins and giggles, even though it's going to drive everybody else crazy, and makes for good audio, I just did a Titan Pad. I will drop into the text messaging with you. There we go. Just so you can see what it looks like. So I think it's the same thing.
One message and the interesting new Skype interface.
Anybody who hasn't seen TitanPad, it's a place you can type at the same time into the same web interface. So I've just pasted in so he could see it. So if look at step 8.
Yeah, I'm seeing those. Yeah, I don't usually see those, but those definitely seem... Okay, so the way Traceroute works is it sends lots and lots of packets out and watches how they go. So that would appear to be lots of different options for hop 8.
But it's spending a few milliseconds on each one. So it's doing something with them.
Well, they're traveling.
Yeah.
Remember, you're not following a packet. You're following the route packets in the general sense take. So it took Traceroute hundreds of packets to discover this routing.
Ah, okay.
So imagine this is a bunch of averages. So hop 5 has a couple of different possible options. Hop 8 had three different options. Hop 10 had three.
So it looked at them, but it picked one?
Well, no, it's showing you everything. So each packet went one way.
Oh, so some packets went on this one, some on the next one, some on the next one. Oh, interesting. Okay.
So think of it sort of in the quantum mechanics sense. Every electron goes through one slit, but on the whole, half of them go through one, half of them go through the other.
Don't start with that.
Okay.
But yes, Steve's favorite topic, by the way.
I can see why. So this is an aggregate of how lots of packets traveled. which tells us in the abstract sense how packets get from you to my server.
Cool.
The point being, they're 16 hops away.
Let me see if I can say this. This is at the this is at the internet level.
This is layer 2, internet level.
Layer 2.
Yeah, so this is actually the magic of routing. So these are how many routers are involved between getting from you to me, or rather from you to my server.
Right, right.
And all of that, by the way, so the milliseconds are sort of cumulative, so all of that takes 166 milliseconds. No, that's not right.
I've got some 176 about... It is not cumulative, is it?
Can't be, because otherwise this doesn't work, because it was 186 further up the chain. No, they're not cumulative. They're...
Yeah, no. They must be.
It can't be.
Got to add them all up. Whole bunch of milliseconds.
Wait, actually, we know that we're about 200 milliseconds apart.
Right. Well, I can just ping this IP address.
You could, actually, and that will tell you how quick a single packet does it, because a ping is one packet.
46.22.130.125. Look at me all over the terminal. Unknown host, because I'm a moron. I added ping and traceroute together.
That's confusing.
Where is it? 46. I think you... 6.20. I hit the up arrow and then typed ping and wasn't looking at what I was typing. So it didn't make any sense. 164 milliseconds.
That's not bad.
That's awesome. We used to see sometimes 400 milliseconds and it got really hard to have a conversation.
Yes. Of course, we're not talking to my web server though. Anyway,
yeah.
So back to our story. So Tracery gives you some idea of how much work is going on at layer one. It's two. Sorry,
yeah. You. Yeah. I'm exhausted looking at how hard it's working.
So if we scroll down a bit in the show notes, because we're not quite following the text, but it's fine. It's better to have a conversation. So to help you imagine it, so remember I said that you're going down, 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 then up, down, up, down, up, down. There's a nice diagram that is from Wiki Commons that shows a network topography. So host A, router, router, host B.
Topology. But
what did I call it?
Typography or something close to that. It had an R in it somewhere. I want to make sure people knew what you meant.
Yes, topology. And so you can see what I'm describing, that the logic is that processes go straight across, but the reality is down, 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 across, up, down, up, down, up, down, and finally all the way up at the other end.
So that shows it in a diagram.
Picture form. So the other thing you might wonder is, well, I wonder how many packets were involved in that little transaction. I mean, we sent a teeny tiny HTTP request, and we got back a very small HTTP response. How many packets were that? Because I tell you, we break things into pieces, and that there's an overhead to TCP where they have to negotiate with each other. So how many packets is it to send that small amount of data? Well, for me, the answer was 12.
Which packet of data? You're talking about that, what you put on the web server?
So between you hitting enter and you seeing the website, 12 packets of data were sent.
Okay.
In either direction.
Okay.
Well, you don't have to take my word for it. We can prove it to ourselves.
Good.
So a command we are going to revisit later is the wonderful command TCP dump.
That sounds like it's got a lot of dump. Gunk on my screen.
Did you just run TCP dump without any options?
No. No.
If you did, there is one line scrolling by you at high velocity for every single UDP packet on this guy.
I didn't do that.
TCP dump shows you every packet of information coming through your router, which is why you'd usually use TCP dump in conjunction with a few options to tell it which packets to show you, because otherwise you will be swamped, especially actually while you're having a Skype conversation, because we're generating lots of packets.
I actually lied. I didn't, but it says operation not permitted when I try, so that's probably good.
It is, because TCP dump requires sudo.
Ah.
Okay. Because what you're doing with TCP dump is that you're telling your... So normally the way it works is that your network card has a MAC address. We said that last week. And normally you're operating... You're only handed the packets that were addressed to you. And everything else is on the network, but is not passed up to you, because it's not for you. But there's a thing called promiscuous mode.
Ooh.
Where you can tell the network card, yeah, whatever, just show me the whole network. Show me everything. And it will pass all packets up. And TCP dump uses promiscuous mode.
That should be called gossip mode. Show me what everybody's talking about.
It's fun, actually, on networks to watch what's going on. You know. But anyway, we'll get back to that, because we're going to look at TCP dump again lots.
Okay.
So for today, we're going to say sudo tcp dump and then minus nn. And I'm not going to tell you what that means.
No.
Well, I will. It just means we want to see the IP addresses, not the DNS names.
Okay.
And the second n means we want to see the port numbers, not the port names.
Okay.
And then we're going to say space host, which says that I only care about packets to or from whatever I put next, which is space, the IP address of my server. So 46.22.130.125. So that command will show every packet that hits your network card that has either a to or a from of my web server.
Okay.
So if you pop that into a terminal, nothing will happen initially because
yeah.
you're not into my server. Okay, enter root password. Sorry, not root. Now go to your browser and visit that page.
So I just refreshed the page and a whole bunch of stuff came out.
Okay, so hit Control C to stop TCP dump capturing more.
Okay.
And it will then give you a little summary.
72,954 packets received by filter.
Okay, so that's everything there was that you didn't see. So above that should be the amount of packets.
25 packets captured.
So that means there were 25 packets for some reason when you refreshed that web page. Interesting.
Let me try it again. Because it did one right after the...
So you're also looking at my show notes, which means that...
14? Do you like 14 better? I did it faster. 14
is plausible. 14 is plausible. I was getting 12, sometimes 13, but 14 is entirely within the realms of believability.
Okay. I might have been doing something else in between, but okay.
Okay.
Oh, because I'm at bartb.ie at the same time, it could be getting some crosstalk over there?
Absolutely could.
Okay.
Because, yeah, it's on the same IP address.
Okay.
And you're seeing everything to that IP address.
So when it says the packets received by filter, does that mean stuff it filtered out and didn't show?
Yeah, so packets received by filter is every packet that hit TCP dump while it was in promiscuous mode.
Hmm.
So you were wondering, I wonder how many packets are flying over and back through your computer. Well, do that for 10 seconds and then stop it and you'll know how many packets fly through your network.
Okay. All right, so now I've got a bunch of glop on my screen. What do I learn anything from that, or are we just looking at the number of packets captured?
Okay, well, we could look at the number, but let's look a little more closely. So what's each line? So each line, when you look at it, is clearly a timestamp. So you're going to probably see it in your local time. I'm going to see it in my local time.
It is. I thought that was an IP address. It's at 11.56.33. Oh, that's 11:56 a.m. Okay,
so the first thing is just the time, and the it's in milliseconds. So you have hours, minutes, seconds, point milliseconds.
Okay.
And then the next line says what protocol was being talked, and the answer is IP.
Right.
The next line is
an IP address.
But the port number is stuck onto the end of it as a fifth.
And it's alternating between my internal IP address at home and your web server. So I'm seeing like a 10.0.1.41, and then it'll go to 46.22.130.125, which is you, then back to me, then back to you.
Correct. So that's that chattering over and back.
Hmm.
So you'll see that, you'll see that on your end, it's a random high number port. And every time we run this, it'll be a different random high number port. But on my end, it's always port 80.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
Because so that's the web server.
It's oddly, what is it, comma 80 or does it say dot 80?
It says dot. It puts it on as a fifth part of the IP address to confuse muggles.
Yeah, why didn't they do colon like they normally do?
You have to find someone who wrote this a long time ago.
Okay.
And for now, really, what you can just see there is the packets going over and back between the port numbers.
Okay. Yeah.
But that's already something. You can make TCP be very, very talkative and show you the binary data as well, but we're not going to do that today.
Okay. We and don't need to learn any of the rest of this, do we?
No, not today.
Okay, good.
We will be using TCP dump for the purposes of trying to figure out what's going on. It's a great troubleshooting tool. Huh. If you think there's a firewall problem, if packets aren't getting through at all, then you know there is a firewall problem because you're not seeing the packets arrive. But if you see the packets arrive and it's still not working, it's not a firewall problem. The packets are there.
Ah, right, right, right.
So it's actually a very useful tool. So that is sort of where we leave it for now. So just, Tell them what you told them. So let's just wrap it up one last time. Our computers use TCP/IP, stacker protocols, link layer at the bottom, internet layer next, transport layer on top, application layer on top. Data travels up and down the layers until it gets to the bottom, then it can go across and back. And that's sort of the very, very, very high picture.
I think the two biggest things I learned from this is that in between, it's doing those little hops just from the link layer to internet to link layer to internet up and down until it gets to the endpoints, and then it goes all the way back up. That was interesting to me.
Yeah, because a router, remember, is a machine that's connected to two networks. So you need a router to pick it up and drop it onto another network. That's how you cross network to network to network to network.
Right, but the fact that they're not having to go all the way up to the application layer and back down was interesting. The other thing I thought was interesting was knowing that that little bit of traffic that's coming back is the server on the other end saying through UDP TCP. Or TCP. TCP saying, TCP. I didn't get that one. Can you resend that one? Hey, I'm having a little trouble here. Fix this.
Yeah, and it is actually, it's also quite polite. It also says how much it got as well. So even if everything's working perfectly and no packets are being dropped, you'll still see that signaling traffic because it's saying, I'm good as far as packet 42. I'm good as far as packet 86. Good as far as packet 5,000,002. And so it does chatter even when things are going perfectly.
Interesting.
The other thing actually, so you were saying it doesn't go all the way up, which is true. But if you use a proxy server talks HTTP, so it would go all the way up inside the proxy server.
Let's not complicate things and get into okay. that. But I think the diagram from Wikimedia really shows that up down from the link to linked internet up and down really well. That's a great drawing.
So from here going forward, the next installment we're going to look at Ethernet. And just not much, but a little bit of what we can do terminal-wise to show us what's going on with our Ethernet can be useful. It can help us troubleshoot sometimes.
Cool.
And then we do TCP and you get the basic idea.
All right. That sounds good, Bart. This was fun.
Okie dokie. Well, until I presume 2 weeks from now.
I think so.
Okay. Well, until then, happy computing.
All right. Well, that was a long show. I promised you a giant show, but we had too much fun. I swear, I looked at the clock and I thought we'd been talking like 45 minutes and I looked and it was an hour and 12. So hope you guys enjoyed that on top of all the other content. That's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping to pay the bills, Blue Mango Learning at bluemangolearning.com, makers of Clarify. Like I said, don't forget, we need you to send in your dumb questions, comments, suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfee.com. Send in audio reviews to Alistair Jenks at zkarj@me.com. And do be sure to send them in something, even if it's a question or, like I said, a tech rant. That would be fun. You can follow me on Twitter at Podfeet. And do check out the NoSilicast Google Plus community. We continue to have a lot of activity on there, a lot of fun. I always post the blog post that I do during the week. I post a little tickler there. So if you want to read stuff during the week, you can do that too. If you want to join in the fun of the live show like Sandy did for the first time for her very first time, and Michael King, who hadn't been here in ages, come on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilicastaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.